So I'm going to saying that this, I'm Mike Grayson. I'm in
January the 22nd in year 2007, and I am interviewing Fred McLafferty, who is a mass spectroscopist at NOAA. And what we're going to do is kind of fill in some blanks. We have some oral history and other material on Fred. There's a nice video history that Cornell has done. We have the Carsten Reinhardt work. So I'm going to try and then pick up things that these other interviews had, as well as get some other insights into Fred's career.
I'm Fred McLafferty, and I'm delighted that we got Mike Grayson here, even though we had to use such a flimsy excuse to do it.
Yes, well, I don't think it's a flimsy excuse, but at any rate, I will, if we run across names, I'll want to write down the spelling of them so that when...
Okay.
And we do that in the order that they occur in the transcript and recording, because then when the transcriptionist sees the name, they'll be able to refer to the spelling. And I'd like you to remind you to try and date things with at least years. You know, I mean,
say what?
Put in years. When we talk about events, let's try and get the year that they occurred in.
Or
the, so we have a kind of a date kind of thing. So actually, one of the first things I would like to find out is, where were you born?
Evanston, Illinois.
Evanston, Illinois.
1923.
Well,
May 11th.
I don't know if this is on the website, the Cornell website, that has your bio.
But
and it says, born May 11th in. So I thought I'd go ahead and get that information out of the way.
And I think Carl Girasi's birthday is the next month.
Oh, really?
So I think he's very young.
Oh, okay. The same year, I assume.
Same year.
Yeah. I did look at the video interview that Cornell had done, and I was interested in the fact that in that interview you mentioned that both your paternal and maternal grandmothers had gone to school, had gone to college. Is that correct? Or did I misunderstand what was said there?
Yes, they'd all gone to college, right.
Would that be...
And one time when our son Joel was applying to Harvard, and he says, and my mother was there, he said, it says here, did I have any relatives that went to Harvard? And my wife and I said, no. My mother said, no, that's not true. You're the second president of, you're descended from the second president of Harvard. So that's according to my mother, and I could look it up. But anyway, no, why are you interested?
Well, I mean, this would have been in the late 1800s, right? For your grandparents, your grandmothers?
Yes.
And were they from the East or the Midwest? Or
both... my grandfather McLafferty and his wife were from El Paso, Illinois.
Okay.
And they did not go to college. And he came earlier to Nebraska because he was Fred McLafferty also, and so I have a teaching certificate for Fred McLafferty dated 1877 in Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay.
You know how to do it, Ralph?
Oh, there's a switch around here someplace.
Oh, I see.
There's not a remote shut off on this one.
Yeah, that's what I remembered, but I couldn't remember. You told me there was a switch, but I... That one thing is turning.
That's a circulating pump, and I can do that right here.
That circulating pump turns it off?
That right, this one in here shuts that little squeaky noise down right there.
Okay.
But that is airflow. Now, is that going to be a problem?
No, the little squeaky noise was the guy that was kind of, we were picking up here.
Okay.
Oh,
all right.
Oh.
So if that's a problem, I can reduce the air for a short time. If you need that, just let me know.
No, I think we're okay.
Thank you.
I think we're okay.
Ralph, you're terrific.
No, thank you.
Okay. So my mother's mother, Julia Lowry, was from Chicago, and she had gone to college. And her brother was assistant superintendent of Chicago Public Schools. And her husband was from Springfield, Ohio, and he had gone to Antioch College.
Okay, I just, you know, looking back at some of the material that I've seen in the past, it was unusual for women to go to college and to get a college degree, even into the 20s, teens and 20s. It was not common, I don't think. And so I just was kind of trying to get a little bit of the educational background. Obviously, education was an important part of your heritage. But
my mother's parents came to Nebraska, and he first lived in a sod house, and they were married in 1883 when she came. Mm-hmm. So they were Nebraskans for a long time.
So now, with regard to your immediate family, your mother and father, your parents, were they in an intellectual environment, or what did your dad do for a living? And
My father was a civil engineer, and they met each other at the University of Nebraska, and my wife's father was a dentist, and her parents met at the University of Nebraska. I met my wife at the University of Nebraska, so that's a real intellectual background.
Yes. But in your family, would you have any brothers and sisters? Or
I have a brother. I have an older sister who lives in Peoria, Illinois, and she got her bachelor's degree and taught school and has four boys. And I have a younger brother who lives in Orangeburg, South Carolina, who is a CPA, but just last month, I went down there to see him get his PhD at age 79.
Wow.
Because all of his children, has three children with PhDs, and his wife died a few years ago, and he decided he would get his PhD. So, don't ask me where all of that came from.
So I'm just trying to get a sense of the intellectual climate in your family growing up.
To go back one more step on my mother's side, my grandfather's name was Joseph Warren Kiefer, K-E-I-F-E-R, Jr., and his father, Joseph Warren Kiefer, Sr., was a major general in the Union Army in the Civil War at age 29, and then became Speaker of the House of Representatives in Washington. And so at least my mother regaled us with stories of sleeping at the White House and things like that. And whether that inspired us, the Depression was hard on all of everybody in Nebraska, including our families. And so let's say my growing up years, I don't remember anything greatly elegant, but the only time I met the great-grandfather was down on the farm. My mother was born in Bostwick, Nebraska.
What was the name of that?
Bostwick, Bostwick, Nebraska. It had 200 people when I was a kid. It hardly has 20 now.
Yeah.
Great-grandfather came, and all the grandchildren came to meet him, and he gave us each a $20 gold piece, and that was really something. And when we started to put it in our pockets, our parents said, let's put them on the top of the piano so everybody can enjoy it. And guess what? Next morning, they weren't there. And we never found out where they went, except it was the height of the Depression.
Mm. So this would have been what, 29, 30?
This was, he died at, this would be around 29 or 30. When I was, I can still remember it, so it must have been 7 years or something.
Mm-hmm. So, was there any person in your early education background that kind of got you interested in science in general or chemistry in particular?
My high school chemistry teacher was great. And
you remember the name?
I can always remember his name, but now I can't.
Well, we'll, you know,
if I remember, I'll come up with it.
So this was high school in what city?
In Omaha.
So you were...
Omaha North High School. And this teacher was great, and I loved chemistry, and I decided I'd do chemistry. And when I... In those days, everybody went to the University of Nebraska. You didn't worry about which college to go to or anything like that.
Just went there.
That's everybody. My sister went there, my brother went there, and everybody I knew went there. And I found, I didn't even know until I got down there that I had to choose between chemistry and chemical engineering. I was so totally naive when I got there, and I took chemistry and, well, I've been in chemistry ever since.
So in your chemistry in high school, was this done, did you just have like a year, like a junior year course, or did you have several years of chemistry with this instructor?
In those days, physics was the junior year course, science course, chemistry was the senior year science course. And you had mathematics and things like that. I enjoyed all of those things, but the chemistry somehow I really liked.
So the teacher and really kind of turned you on to the whole thing.
And I did have chemistry set in the basement, and my neighborhood friends and I concocted things, but it was the chemistry teacher in high school that really did.
Interesting. If you do get to the Chemical Heritage Foundation, they have a collection of old chemistry sets.
So you might
be able to find your old chemistry set there.
Oh, on top of that, the old University of Omaha was just a few blocks from where we lived in Omaha. And in fact, we went by it every day to go to Lothrop Grade School. And in those days, they used to throw the old stuff out the window or out the door. So outside of the building, there would be glass and rubber stoppers and things like that, just lying there on the ground.
Great environmental protection type thing.
Great environmental protection. But we thought it was great. You know, you get a rubber stopper with a glass tube sticking through. This really increased your chemistry research prospects greatly. So I remember that.
So then in Nebraska, you knew you decided to go to chemistry. Chemical engineering was not a consideration. You went forward in chemistry. And so when did you enter the school in Nebraska?
It was
in 1940.
Yeah, September 1940.
And then, let's see, America was, where were we with the war in Germany at that time? Were we involved with the...
December 7th, 1941, it was Pearl Harbor.
Okay, it was Pearl Harbor.
So Pearl Harbor came when I was a sophomore.
And
in fact, organic chemistry was sophomore level, and my teaching assistant was Bob Albert. Now Alberty, and Bob Alberty has been in the National Academy since many, many years. He was at the University of Wisconsin as a professor, and then he went to MIT as provost, I think, or dean of science or something like that. And he and his wife, Vancouver's at the University of Nebraska then, is a good friend of not only my wife, but especially her sister, and so we see them. And so anyway, the people like that were an influence early on.
So this was like the lab instructor?
The lab instructor. Yeah. Okay. He got his master's degree at the University of Nebraska, as I remember. And so this would have been like 1941.
So the curriculum there was pretty much standard for that time. We have an introductory chemistry course. Did you do any inorganic? I guess you had some inorganic.
And we had analytical with fumes. It was on the first floor, and we had to have the windows open when the fumes got so bad.
So you didn't have hoods in these labs?
And the organic lab, I remember that there was a fire in the sink at least every lab period.
So how big were these classes?
Oh, gee, I don't remember. The lecture hall was pretty big. I think there were a few hundred people in the general chemistry class.
And I guess chemistry was at Nebraska was always an important subject because of the relationship to the agricultural industry.
That's right. The Ag College actually, I think, had its... I don't know if it had its own... how much of its own chemistry it had. It was out in the suburbs, and so you couldn't walk from the Ag campus like you can at Cornell.
Yeah.
Cornell's medical school is in New York City, so it's the universal walk there, and you're at WashU, you're very lucky.
So. Yeah. So, in a lot of schools today, chemistry and organic chemistry, these courses are prerequisite for medical degrees going to medicine, but I guess at Nebraska at that time, it was kind of prerequisite for going into the agricultural area for a lot of students.
Well, the University of Nebraska was a land-grant college, and certainly the Ag School was a very important part of it. And, what career choices did people have? That's a good question. We didn't see much of that because everybody went to the war.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that we didn't see that part of career choices. That's such a big thing for students.
Yeah.
Now it should be.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But that wasn't something that people even kind of thought about.
Thought about at that time. Before we go on, I just want to, can you clarify what is meant by a land-grant college?
Oh, the Morrill Land-Grant Act of 1865.
The M-O-R-R-I-L?
M-O-R-R-I-L-L.
Okay.
In fact, Cornell is the land-grant college of the state of New York.
Okay.
Each of the states was authorized by the federal government to start a college, what they called a college or university, and it had to have mechanic arts, which of course is engineering now,
mm-hmm.
and agriculture and military science.
Okay.
And that what the government gave them was a land grant in order to put the college on.
The place
so,
to put it.
The federal government had lots of land in Nebraska, and so they gave them land, not only land to put it on, but land to support it. For Cornell, there wasn't any federal land in New York State, so they gave Cornell Upper Michigan land that was worth 5 cents or 10 cents an acre or something.
And I see.
And the way Cornell, Ezra Cornell himself, saved the university was when they were strapped for money and all they could get was he bought this land for 5 or 10 cents an acre and set it up in some way when they sold it they got a dollar or $3 or things like that an acre, which made a big difference.
So you're telling me that the federal government gave Cornell gave the state of New York land in a different
in upstate Michigan.
In Michigan.
Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
The UP. So this is really useful for New York State, right?
Well, every state got, and so for Iowa, there's Iowa and Iowa State, and mm-hmm. Iowa State's the land grant. In Nebraska, they have only the University of Nebraska, and that's the land grant college. And I guess in Missouri, I'm not sure which is the land grant.
Probably the University of Missouri, I would guess, but
well,
I don't
they
know.
They have to have an ag college and an engineering college. In Indiana, Purdue is the land grant college,
yeah.
And of course, Indiana University has arts and
sure.
things like that.
So basically, he leveraged the land, the value of the land in Michigan, the UP, to buy a property here so they could have their...
Well, actually, this was Ezra Cornell's farm.
Oh, okay.
For the university. So he, and he gave money besides. But there was a big fight in the state legislature of what place in New York State would get this bonanza of the university. And Ezra was in the legislature, and he had made a lot of money on Western Union Telegraph, and so that's how it worked at Cornell. At Nebraska, I think things were simpler because the land was there, and they had essentially no university, so this was their first university.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the Morrill Act was in 1865.
Just at the end of the Civil War.
1865. That's kind of neat. See, that's an interesting part of our history of the country that I didn't realize. But I mean, you hear about people speaking about land grant colleges, and you know, you just kind of think, well, it means something.
And that's because the federal government didn't give them any money, but they had lots of land.
Interesting. So. Let's talk then a little bit about that business with the war. Okay, you came to start your college career in 1940, and my understanding is that you were able to get an accelerated completion of your bachelor's degree.
Yes, let's see, how did it go? Well, I've taken. Well, a land grant college is supposed to have military education, and they even had ROTC in high school, and I took ROTC at college. And so the war started in my sophomore year, and training facilities for troops were a tremendous problem. And so just having the ROTC there to train people was something. And so they came up with this deal that if you'd been in the ROTC and would stay in that training, you could then you have to enlist, but then they would leave you there for a while so you could still continue your education. And so this gets us around to the spring of to the fall of 1942. So that's the start of my junior year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enlisted in the infantry in September of 1942, but I got to stay on campus, and they then called us. There were lots of us who had done this same thing, and they called us to active duty in April of 1943, but they actually let us finish the semester. They put us in the library building and housed us there and gave us uniforms and everything like that. Well, that meant that I could finish my third year, and the university came up with a plan that if you weren't more than 16 hours short of the 120 required for graduation, you could get your bachelor's degree. Well, I'd gone to summer school, and I've taken larger loads and so forth, and so I had enough So I actually got a bachelor's degree in 3 years at the same time that we had to go to basic training in the Army and everything else. But of course, I got to get my bachelor's degree and so forth. And the other thing that was part of the deal was if you go to 4 years of ROTC, they make you a second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. If you go to 3 years of ROTC, you automatically got to go to officer candidate school. Mm-hmm. And just as well tell you the story. So after basic training, I got to go to officer candidate school. It's, I think, a 13-week school at Fort Benning, Georgia, infantry basic training. The very last week, they called me in before the officers' review board, and they said, "Well, yours is a very different case than we think we've ever seen, and we're having a big argument about it." Well, what's that? He says, "Well, some of us think you look 14 years old, and that would be difficult to lead troops." And I said, "Well, what do the others think? They think you look 13. And so I got bounced.
So you had the age and the training, but you didn't have the looks.
They also told me I had the highest IQ score, Army test score, that anybody had come in there to.
Really?
So maybe they bounced me to save my test score.
So I just want to back up a second on these college. What was the typical course load? Was it like 18 hours, 19 hours, 20?
Well, I think I took 18 hours. Or 19.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I also took the summer after my sophomore year, when the war was on, I took a laboratory organic course or something, mm-hmm. in the summer, so that's how I got the necessary.
So when the OCS bounced you, then that meant you went back into a non-com position, or?
Well, no, I was private first class.
Private first class,
and I got to train. Luckily, I got to train with the infantry rifle company that we then went overseas, and we didn't go overseas until Thanksgiving Day 1944,
mm-hmm.
and so the invasion of Europe, and we went in through Marseille, and we got into the southern end of the Ardennes offensive and things like that, then of course the war was over in May of 45.
So you saw a little less than a year, maybe 8-9 months of.
Just from December through April.
About 6 months.
I think officially our unit was 110 days in combat,
okay.
And I spent 10 days in the hospital. But for anybody that thinks that's a short time, I had one Purple Heart for getting wounded,
mm-hmm.
and 193 men in an infantry rifle company, but my one Purple Heart was below average because our rifle company had a total of 194 Purple Hearts. So, and 39 killed in action.
You had 39 of that group, 193?
20%.
Wow.
Killed in action, so.
So you're...
Incidentally, they offered me what they call a battlefield commission. I must have aged.
So,
I turned down the battlefield commission.
Okay.
I knew by then what second lieutenants
had to do. So
every single one of our second lieutenants were the killer.
Okay. So you decided that really wasn't something you wanted.
It was a great honor, but as they said about the man when they were riding out of town on the tarting on a rail, if it weren't for the other thing, I'd just soon walk.
Yeah. So then you stayed as a private first class through the whole...
No, actually, the guys above me, let's see, the section leader got wounded, so my squad leader got the job. Then my squad leader got wounded as section leader, and I became squad leader. And then when he got wounded as section leader, I became section leader, so I was a staff sergeant.
Okay.
At the end of it. And the thing about the infantry was there's a point system for getting out of the Army after the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
And the first people out had to have 85 points. And I had exactly 85 points. And so I was back at the University of Nebraska Graduate School that fall, the fall of 45. And as Mike Gross has pointed out to many people, nobody else was back from the Army, only the crippled and the blind males were there, and so that's when I caught Tibby Phil. So that was the best part of being in the Army.
So on this point system, you're only in for, 100 and some odd days, but you were able to amass 85 points. What counted toward points?
Well, you got a point for every month in the United States and 2 points for every month overseas, but the biggest thing was that you got 5 points for a medal. So I had a combat infantry badge and a Purple Heart and 5 Bronze Star medals for valor, and that adds.
So this was an exceptional event for most people for that short period of time to have acquired that many combat commendations?
Yeah.
So what did you do to get all that stuff, Brett?
I got lucky. Vivian, do you want to hear one story? One I might tell my grandchildren about. The rest of my, don't tell anybody about it. My best buddy was Don Woods. And Don was just a year younger than I, but he had gone several years to the University of Oklahoma, and we were interested in the same things, and we hung out together and everything else. And as I say, very conscientious, though, but different than I am. We had had a real tough attack one day, trying to push the Germans out of the land in front of the Siegfried Line. We were back and we'd sort of quit for the day, and it was getting dusk, and we were sitting around, I don't know what, and this major that we didn't know came up with a medic. Medics had red crosses on their helmets and so forth, and he says, "We've got this problem. This guy, guy in your company, got shot out in the attack. And when we had to pull back, he's out there, and the medics have gone out to treat him and get him. And the Germans have decided to shoot medics today. We've already lost one medic, and this guy who was with him said, and he had a hole in his shirt or something like that." And he said, "So as soon as it gets dark, we've got to sneak out there with a stretcher and bring him back." And he says, "I need 2 volunteers." And this Don Woods jumps up and he says, "Sir, we will volunteer." So we went out and we got the guy. The Germans were somehow... they knew we'd be out there, so they were targeting any noise. And on the way back, we made some noise, and so we got a lot of artillery thrown in on us. And Don got a piece of shrapnel in his arm, and uh, I uh, I I came through fine. I'm a lucky guy. And so the major was very pleased we'd done this and put us in for Silver Stars. And Don really wasn't badly hurt, but it turned out that for years he had trouble with his arm where the skin hadn't really been penetrated too much, but it damaged his tendons. Mm-hmm. And stuff. Anyway, he got a Purple Heart for that, as he should. Well, then Don had applied for West Point, and while we were in the front lines, his appointment came through. He didn't tell anybody, and I saw the next letter that came through a couple of weeks later saying, "Didn't you get the letter?" I saw him opening it and saw the return address was a very official letter, and of course I insisted on reading it, and I said, "What are you still doing here?" "Well, I can't leave my buddies." Mm-hmm. And I, of course, spoke up loudly so everybody, and within hearing, could hear what the story was. And I said, "How many of you guys would stay here if you got one of these?" And everyone said, "Hell no, we'd be out of here." So we shoved him out of there. Anyway, when he gets back to West Point that summer, you're just starting at West Point and you're a plebe or a rookie or whatever it is, they really treat you like a pledge or something. But he wasn't there but a week or two, and the general called a parade for the whole outfit, and then he announced the parade is to award medals. And Don got the Silver Star and the Purple Heart in front of all these guys. He never got harassed.
Mm-hmm. After that.
Yeah.
No, he had the real harassment in the war.
Well, my stories are very long, but...
No. Well,
so that's the one I tell about. So, okay. Anyway, Don got the Silver Star, but I got demoted to the Bronze Star.
Well, he volunteered you.
I never complained, but I know that's what the answer would be, that I didn't volunteer.
So that you were able to bring back this wounded fellow. I mean, he survived, and
we honestly never found out if he survived.
He was alive when you got to him,
but he was in terrible shape. In terrible shape. But we did get him back, and we.
So, when you were...
You volunteered.
So, what led to your Purple Heart? I mean, that's a commendation for wounded in action, right?
Yeah, I was next to a 88 shell that went off and blew out my ears and put some shrapnel in me.
So, your luck would run out on that one.
Yeah, well, 10 days in the hospital, that's... A million-dollar wound is where you are wounded badly enough that they have to ship you back to the States, but you recover.
Mm-hmm.
And mine was a $1,000 wound. I got 10 days off.
So you went back into combat then after your 10 days?
Yeah, I went back in combat. And it was after I got back in combat I was a squad leader before when I got wounded, and then sort of the second day I was back, my former squad leader, who was the section leader, got wounded, and then I was the section leader, staff sergeant for the last few weeks of the war.
So you were able to come back immediately then?
Come back
immediately after the war had ended. Were you able to return?
Yeah,
to
actually, the first we of course the war had to end in Japan,
Right. I mean, a lot of my understanding is a lot of the guys in Europe were looking, not forward to, but looking at the possibility of having to go to the city.
Oh, yeah. That's, we were already of occupation that summer in Europe, and we were headed for Japan. Our unit was headed for Japan. So
since you had a sufficient number of points, you were able to
talk to that. Then, as soon as the war was over, actually, I sailed out, I've forgotten, fairly early in September. And of course, the war wasn't officially over until like September 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was discharged like the 3rd of October or something. And it turned out that the University of Nebraska was glad to accept me as a grad student. I didn't know any chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't remember the difference between benzene and acetone.
Did you consider, I mean, I know, you know, at that point in your life, in the life of a young person, you know, the interruption in your education is considered to be kind of a, not something you want to do. You know, I mean, it's an inconvenience. How did people view the fact that the war was going to impinge on their ability? I mean, a lot of people probably had to stop in the middle of their college education to go off to war. And typically, at that age, you're not terribly excited about, you know, interrupting your studies.
Well, the interesting part about the wars we have now and the people that have to go and so forth, it was World War II was entirely different. Nebraska World War II, let's put it that way. I think it was that way all over the country. But girls would ask you, why are you in the university?
Why aren't you?
Yeah, you know, aren't you 18? You know,
uh-huh.
It was what you did.
Yeah,
it's what you did. And for me to enlist in the infantry, I was on the rifle team in college, so that's the only reason they let me in the infantry. It's a very exclusive club. Hardly anybody can get in.
But you get shot at a lot.
Me and a few million other guys.
Yeah, right.
And maybe the other thing was that the career. When you asked about careers, that was a very interesting question for me because. I can't remember even ever thinking about a career during that time, or being interrupted on my career.
Yeah.
Because the war was such a huge part of everyday life and everybody's conversation and the radio and everything else that you, and there were draft boards and there were, scrap drives and victory gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And you just I never thought of having my career interrupted.
My sense, because I was born in 41, so I have no real true experience of it, but my sense is that it was a time when the entire country was mobilized. I mean, everybody.
Sure.
I know my dad used to talk about, he was a traveling salesman, and they rationed tires, they rationed butter, they rationed copper, they rationed gas, they rationed everything for the war effort. And I think it's probably incomprehensible for people in this generation, this age now, to understand how completely involved the whole country was in the war. Before we leave the war, I've got one question I want to ask you. Did you ever serve near Dresden? In Germany?
Dresden?
Yeah, Dresden.
No, I've been to Dresden since then, but
because you're familiar with someone who did serve in Dresden, I think.
What?
You're familiar with someone who did serve close to Dresden.
Who is that?
Klaus Biemann.
Oh, Klaus. Yeah, I forgot that. I didn't realize. Yes, I didn't know that.
It's in the literature, and it's also an interview I did that when the war ended, he was in Dresden. at the time that the war ended.
In uniform.
Yeah. And he actually, when it was obvious that the war was over, and that, you know, he essentially walked back to Innsbruck, hiked back to Innsbruck from Dresden to get back to his family. So he was on the other side.
Oh, I've never heard that story.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad you told me.
Well, that's, you know, yeah. So I think we can move forward then from there. You went back to Nebraska and then relearned your chemistry.
Relearned my chemistry.
You graduated.
Took it. I was an analytical chemist.
Analytical chemist. So you went in, did you graduate as an analytical chemist? So you went and took a master's degree there?
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that the great analytical chemist, well, the only analytical chemist in the National Academy until Charlie Riley got in the 70s, was Koltoff.
How do you spell that?
University of Kolt-Hoff.
Okay.
Initials are I.M.
Mm-hmm.
Isaac M. Koltoff, but he was, everybody called him Pete.
Pete.
Anyway, Pete Koltoff was a bachelor and lived in Minnesota, and I remember visiting him at age 95 when he was living in the student union. Anyway, I got my master's degree with Professor Armin Pagel, P-A-G-E-L.
Mm-hmm.
And Pagel got his PhD from Koltoff and Sandel. And the famous old analytical quantitative analysis textbook was Koltoff and Sandel, and so I felt like I was a real analytical chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And my first two papers out of my master's degree, and they were both published in analytical chemistry.
Hmm. Okay, and this would have been in late 40s?
Late 40s.
Late 40s?
48 or 49, something like that.
Okay, use of tributyl phosphate for extracting organic acids to make good solutions. Yeah. Analytical chemistry.
Sounds exciting, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Well, you got to start somewhere. So, then you got your master's degree, and you decided to explain how you ended up. But you went to Cornell, right, for your PhD?
You need all the story. Well, I was still pretty naive, and so I talked to Tibby about it, and we decided that.
No, you got married when?
Oh, that's right. I didn't get married then. I got married in 48, so after. I graduated in June of 47 with a master's degree, and we got married in February of 48.
Okay.
Because she graduated in January of 48.
And what did she study in?
Bacteriology.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And anyway, decided that Cornell was far east as far as Nebraska's concerned, but not totally far east, and that, so I applied to Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And the chair of the department there was a friend of Jack Johnson, who was the big organic chemist here, and one day they named the chemistry building after that. Anyway, the chair stopped me in the hall and said, where are you going to grad school? And I said, oh, Cornell. He says, oh, have you had an offer? I said, well, actually, I sent the application in months before, and I haven't heard anything. Well, where else did you apply? I said, no, I didn't apply any place else. And he rolled his eyes. But apparently, he got on the phone, and within a few days, I had an offer from Cornell.
So
things still worked.
Yeah, well, you know, the old network. But, I mean, obviously, he wouldn't have done this for anybody. I mean, called up his buddy at Cornell, so he must have been.
Well, in fact, I got a research position on a Navy research grant with the guy I worked for here, which in those days grants weren't very, there weren't a lot of grants, which was a great help since I had the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm. So you were able to use GI Bill funds for your education then?
Yeah, Timmy worked too. Oh, I tell you, we were living high.
Yeah.
Got a car.
Yeah, it must have been something. So you ended up coming to Cornell in
1947. Yes.
47.
In fall of 47.
Fall of 47. And then your thesis work was on floral?
Organic, organofluorine compounds. Chlorofluoral compounds.
What was the interest in those at that time?
My thesis advisor, William T. Miller.
That's M-I-L-L-E-R?
Just Miller, like in
yeah.
Miller.
Mm-hmm.
William T. Miller. Ran a lab on the Manhattan Project, and he invented the lubricants that were used in the uranium hexafluoride diffusion plant that would stand up. Uranium hexafluoride is almost as corrosive as fluorine itself,
mm-hmm.
and these fluids would stand up to that for vacuum pumps and greases and so it was an entirely different field of chemistry, and I found it fascinating. He was especially good in that he used what I thought were modern instruments.
Mm.
He had multi-point recorders, and we put thermocouples into our distillation columns. And, I thought that was really sexy. We could plot out our a freezing point curve to see the purity. We can plot that out on the recorder. I thought that was exciting.
So you were able to use a lot of your analytical chemistry training from masters in your work here.
Analytical is how you define it. And
mm-hmm.
so I've always, I didn't dare tell him I was doing analytical chemistry. I mean, he was an organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
But after I got out, I found it easier for me to call myself an analytical chemist. Well, they didn't trust me to teach organic chemistry or physical chemistry, so it's much easier to call myself an analytical chemist.
Okay. So you basically went through the program here in a pretty normal amount of time. 3 years was about typical for getting a PhD degree.
I finished in the fall of 49. So
oh, okay.
Was here 2 years and 2 months. But of course, I don't know. It didn't seem like it was unusual for me to get out then, but maybe he wanted to get rid of me.
Yeah, I think you were, it progressed pretty rapidly, and so this was like 1949.
Yeah. 47, I came here, and 49, my degree is actually 50 because we left here in November of 49.
Mm-hmm.
And Tibby always likes to joke is that she had the car packed and you saw where we walked in,
uh-huh.
the steps down there. She had the car sitting there, and my PhD exam was in the first room inside there. And as soon as I shook people's hands, I walked down the steps and got in the car, and we were out of town in 10 minutes. So anxious to get rid of Ithaca.
Yeah.
But 19 years later, we came back.
So a few things happened in the intervening period, and I understand you tried to get a job in academia for starters, and when you got out of
I did a postdoc in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
And that was with Ralph Schreiner. Back in those days, S-H-R-I-N-E-R. Schreiner. S-H-R-I-N-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Schreiner.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a famous organic analytical book called I was going to say it until I stopped to say Schreiner again. qualitative organic analysis or something like that. Anyway, it's where you identify molecules by making derivatives and getting their melting points and seeing what color they are and so forth. And I didn't work on that with Schreiner, but he could be called an analytical as well as an organic chemist. And he was in this same famous Roger Adams School of Organic Chemistry out of University of Illinois that all of these other people were.
So what is the Roger Adams School?
Organic chemistry was not as important. Well, maybe that's not true. But physical chemists look down their nose at organic chemistry. But then Roger Adams became department chair at the University of Illinois and got some very bright young organic chemists there, and he then sort of dominated the graduate school scene. He had a pipeline to DuPont, and so he could place his PhDs any place. DuPont had to take them, but he placed them in universities and so Nebraska had one of his students. Cornell had one of his students. Schreiner was on the faculty there, and then went to Indiana, and then went to Iowa. And the university organic chemistry departments were populated with Illinois organic chemists.
So he kind of moved organic chemistry up a notch.
He did. He did indeed, and they still have great organic chemistry in Illinois. But there are others now. Yes, there are others. Anyway. This. What was I?
We were getting ready to look at our position.
Oh, that's right. We were so I thought, well, I have a postdoctorate. I'm going to do academia, and so
was that a 1 year appointment?
That was a 1 year appointment, and so we went there. December of 49, and so I was looking at academic positions in the fall of 1950, and I think I only had one interview, and maybe I didn't get an offer there. But I went to the ACS meeting, the fall ACS meeting, and went through industrial job hunting, and gee, I had all sorts of interviews when I went to Dow to interview at the organic lab of Dow, when I arrived, they said, "Oh, you'll spend the afternoon in the organic lab, but in the morning you're going to interview in the spectroscopy lab." I'm not a spectroscopist. Well, that's all right. There's an opening in mass spectrometry. I've never seen a mass spectrometer. That's where you're going. And so this Vic Caldecor, you've got to write his name down. Caldecor, CaldeCourt, Victor Caldecor, had a mass spectrometer, a Westinghouse mass spectrometer, and was building a second mass spectrometer like the Westinghouse. And he was terrific with electronics and instrumentation. And he had to do all of the analytical and interpreting spectra and everything else. And he said, "Well, we just need a chemist to do this stuff. And it's really very simple." I said, "Well, I've never seen it before." "Well, look and see." And he showed me this mass spectrum of normal butane. He said, "You see, here there's a peak at 58. He says, "It's C4H10. Of course, there's got to be a peak at 58. You see this peak at 43? Well, that's because it's lost 15, methyl group's 15. And see the 29? Well, that's half of the molecule." He says, "See how simple it is?" I said, "Yeah." I said, and so, well, anyway, to make a long story short, I took the job. And all my friends, when they'd say, oh, where are you going to work? And I'd say, oh, I'm going to do mass spectrometry now. Mass spectrometry! Should have heard him yell.
Yeah.
Oh, you dumb guy. And, and I did get an offer from the organic place, and I forgot what I was going to do. And I'd tell them, and they'd say, oh, that really sounds exciting. Mm. Well, I'm going to do mass spectrometry.
Let me back up just a second on when you did look for academic positions. Did you say? I mean, obviously, it's not more than one. I mean, for graduate school, you applied to Cornell, and that was it. But when you started looking for positions in academia, you sent out more than one application.
Yeah, I did. But Ralph Schreiner wasn't a great help. I mean, if I have a student and he wants be an academe, there are all sorts of things they do.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph Schreiner, absolutely a wonderful person. I mean, apartments were very hard to find in 1950 when we went there, so we lived with them for 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Bless her.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote to places that had ads in CNU News. I've forgotten what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say it was not a well planned attack, but the other thing was there happened to be a time. Well, my excuses are there were jobs, but let's face it, if you don't get a job offer, there's another reason.
No, well, but you know.
But I think the only place that I interviewed was Knox College in Western Illinois, and one of my colleagues here that I actually do research with is Barbara Baird, who went to Knox College.
Hmm.
And so when I once in a while remind her of my only other academic interview, she likes to kid me about, well, I'm glad to see they had good taste when they should turn it down.
Nice to have friends, Fred. So, mass spectrometry was, you know, something occurred to me when I was getting ready for this, and there's this kind of situation that occurred at this time. Cy Myerson, Ron Grigsby, you, O.P. Tanner, they would bring someone in for a job interview and more or less put them in front of a mass spectrometer and say, you're going to do this, you know. And so they're turning over a multi-tens of thousand-dollar equipment to somebody who walks, essentially kind of walks in off the street.
Yeah,
and
right.
I thought, that's kind of crazy. You wouldn't do that today. But then on the other hand, if you think about it, no one was qualified. I mean, they didn't have mass spectroscopists like today. So it kind of, in my mind, I don't know if maybe I'm missing something here, kind of suggest how corporate keeping up with the Joneses was that everybody had to have this new instrument, and even though there was no one that they could find qualified to run it, they would figure, you know, well, we'll just pick this guy, looks like a possibility, put him in front of the machine and say, here, you know, do it, make it happen. So, you know, I mean, if you think about those days and the fact that people were essentially assigned this job without a heck of a lot of
I suspect the reason I got the job offer is because when Vic Caldecort showed me this instrument, I was genuinely interested.
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated with this, and I asked him questions, why does this do that? And Vic was only had a bachelor's degree, but he was a very bright guy.
Mm-hmm.
He loved electronics and vacuum systems and things like that, but he was perfectly capable of doing these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I assume that, as you say, there wasn't anybody they could hire that was familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
They could have, if they'd known about Cy Myerson, they could have stolen him away from Stanford, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been perfect for him. But to give them credit, this spectroscopy lab, I should get that in there. They were great. Mm-hmm. Norman Wright that ran it was, well, there's W-R-I-G-H-T, Norman Wright. There's a Pittsburgh Conference Prize that has his name on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an early infrared spectroscopist that really used infrared for solving problems. And his lab there invented the double beam infrared spectrometer. Well, two places invented it at the same time,
mm-hmm.
but his lab was one of them. And so his infrared lab was the best in the world. And that was part of the reason it was great fun for me there.
Mm-hmm.
They were competition, but they had, you know, thousands of reference samples, and they had they've got the first collator card sorters and things like that, and I could use any of this stuff that they had. And besides that, they invented the direct reading emission spectrometer, and somebody else, Alcoa also invented it.
Mm-hmm.
But during the war, they were big on magnesium,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that's just a big 3-meter spectrograph with photo cells set for the wavelengths of the different
mm-hmm.
elements,
mm-hmm.
and they could run the sample every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys were there, and they were, in fact, my direct boss, Jason Saunderson, who was a really, really bright guy.
That's Saunderson, SAU?
SAU, Saunderson, who's still alive up in New Hampshire. We got a Christmas card from him. Jason was terrific, and he was part of the team that did these direct reading spectrometers. They had some of the best X-ray, powder diffraction X-ray in the world. Ludo Fervell, a terrific scientist, and they did some X-ray crystallography.
Let's get that name again.
Ludo, L-U-D-O, Fervell, F-R-E-V-E-L.
That's one word.
That's one word.
Ludo Fervell.
No, Ludo is the first name.
Oh, Ludo Fervell.
Ludo is the first name.
Yeah.
And Fervell's the last name. And he had one of the best X-ray facilities in the world, both for powder diffraction and for crystallography. They had one of the first NMR people. I think his name. I got to know Jim Shulery through Ned.
How do you do, Shulery?
S H O O L E R.
E R Y.
Yeah, he was the Varian, Varian Associates NMR guy. Through Ned. Oh, Ned. Sorry.
Hmm.
Anyway. They had Raman. They had a Raman spectroscopist who never, and all of us developed things that would do things for the Dow Chemical Company as well as have fun with our science.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I thought of it was because the Raman guy, I don't think, really succeeded. In those days, the Raman source was the Toronto Art,
mm-hmm.
and cylindrical thing,
mm-hmm.
and sensitivity was horrible. But anyway, they tried all these spectroscopy methods just because they were so successful with them, and so of course they would try mass spectrometry, and of course they would support me. And when I said, "Well, I need more people and I need more mass spectrometers," it was a laissez-faire, entirely different than industry
now.
You do something good for them, and things go very well.
So How was it? Did you you did a Westinghouse instrument when you got there? So what was that instrument like? I mean, in terms of the kind of spectrum produced, how long it took to take a spectrum?
Oh,
how you got a stand
and
do it?
Well, it was a 90-degree magnetic sector.
90 degrees.
And magnetic sector, okay. So with a near source.
Okay.
A scan took 30 minutes.
30 minutes?
30 minutes.
Were you scanning the voltage or the magnet?
We were scanning the magnet.
Because the early CEC machine scanned voltage.
The early CEC machine also had a photoplane.
No.
And this one had a pentamine recorder. And this Vic Caldercord had made this into a machine that really was analytical.
Mm-hmm.
For example, for the pen and ink recorder, he had a switching system that if it started up the peak fast enough, it factored quickly put in a factor of 10 reduction. If it was still going too fast, it put in another factor of 10. And so with a 30-minute scan, the time it takes you to go over a peak, and of course we were scanning mass 12 to 100 and some, usually we didn't scan past 120.
Yeah.
And so then you could get the peak top and it would switch back. He also put a magnetometer into the magnet that vibrated, and so he got a direct DC feed of the magnetic field. He fed this into a little machine that took exposed movie film and made it run by a window in the front of the mass spectrometer control with a light behind it, and you could use a pencil and make marks on this film. And so that was our mass scale. And so the operator, while the thing is running, he sees the water peak goes by, he sees that his mass scale is calibrated, here goes the 28 of nitrogen and the 32 of air, and he gets to know these peaks well enough, and if he's running xylenes, he marks the 106 and makes sure that it's on. And then we had, though we got a big strip chart, usual paper chart of the mass spectrum out, it would have notated by the operator what the masses were along the bottom, and of course you could read this double thing, and so you just take a ruler, a millimeter ruler, and know what your abundances are. And then for liquid samples to do quantitative analysis, we had a big expansion point.
Mm-hmm.
We had a 5-liter flask inside a heated reservoir. In the top, the glass bore put a thing with about a 1/4-inch hole,
mm-hmm,
in it, and you had a device you put on top of the hole. The hole was plugged with a Teflon slug.
Mm-hmm.
I think I still have a Teflon slug just sitting in my drawer because I love to admire it. So
this is from 1950?
This is a 1952 Teflon slug.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if that has a hole in it or not. Anyway.
They had Teflon in 1952?
Yep.
No, yeah, it's got a little hole on the side.
Yep. And so here in this hole sits a blank Teflon plug. Then this little holder he designed held this and another blank plug on top of it. That holder he put on there, you squeeze the handle, and it pushed two plugs in and left, so this one with the sample went in and left one to plug the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And we weighed this on a balance,
mm-hmm,
ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And you could weigh it with the other plug on top of it as a seal.
Mm-hmm.
And he invented all those things. There's a 1954 analytical chemistry article by Victor Caldecort about these things. And so we ran a real analytical lab. And thanks to all of Vic's...
let me get a picture of that. I'm sorry, I got my camera here.
You want a picture of that?
Yeah, I want a picture of that.
Very few things I am able to keep very long, but I, every once in a while, I...
So...
Maybe you want it on this black
That'll say nice background there. So you guys were really into this analytical thing, and you were able to actually get essentially quantitative determinations of the amount of the various amounts in the mixture.
And it's according to...
I just have to push the record button again. Okay. So Dow really was investing a very large effort in this analytical, physical analytical chemistry.
Yeah, they were really ahead of most places. And well, the thing about the Pittsburgh conference is that I could meet the people from other places. And yeah, but Dow had a big presence at the Pittsburgh conference, and so when I went there, I was always very proud to be from Dow, because in those days that was an important part of the modern analytical.
Yeah.
Of course, the qualitative and quantitative analysis was still a big thing, and the Pittsburgh conference was much more an industrial, and places like Alcoa and steel companies and so forth that had it was industrial analytical problems that sort of drove the conference.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the mass spectrometry was driven by the petroleum industry.
Yeah.
As you well know.
Oh yes. Yeah
And so there were not so many of us that...
So in a sense then, I mean, Dow was not really into petrochemicals, were they, significantly?
No, Dow was not. It was later on that they used... they had things like chlorobenzene and phenol and so forth that came... basically from petrochemicals. Originally, their benzene came from coal tar, but they were petrochemically based for those things. Styrene was a very big thing for them. Yeah, they had a big petrochemical base,
okay.
but it was... at least in those days, there was a much bigger markup between raw materials and products than what you think of when you say petrochemical industry these days.
So, getting back to the Westinghouse, that was considered to be a fairly good piece of equipment for mass spec at the time?
The petroleum industry had CEC.
Mm-hmm.
And to CEC's credit, they had standardized things so that you got these wonderfully reproducible spectra. You ran butane every morning to see if the 58-43 ratio was the same, and you changed the temperature of the ion source and it wasn't. And of course the API reference spectra weren't qualitative spectra, they were quantitative reference
mm-hmm.
spectra. And all of those things I tremendously enjoyed those petroleum people. One thing we could do if you want before we're done is go through those early mm-hmm. things and just point out the people, because
mm-hmm.
the people were wonderful people. And, you know, Jack O'Neill and Jack Sharkey and Gus Friedel and
mm-hmm.
all of these people were, but the number that we're doing non-petroleum things. We're small, and yet, as far as I was concerned, there were plenty to do that the new things pleased my boss, because, of course, there was no... Actually, the Dow had mass spectrometers at their Texas division, too. I'll take it back.
Okay.
And they had General Electric mass spectrometers, and they were 90-degree sector.
Okay.
And but that almost all the petroleum companies just had CEC.
Yeah, my first experience was one of the old 103C that O.P. Tanner had at Monsanto. And so we actually did the solographic recording with the paper you had to develop in the darkroom, where you put the sleeve on and all that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting machine.
I got a 103 at Dow in 53, I think.
Okay.
And with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we used it, and by then, of course, with the other two instruments, we could use the right instrument for the right problem. But, yeah, it was a fine machine, and the photographic thing was a nuisance, but they could do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we ran two shifts a day, on 8 in the morning till 12 at night, on three instruments.
Hmm.
Well, 30 minutes of spectrum is a lot different than modern spectrum every second kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So the work that you did, was it supporting process stream someplace? Or
All sorts. That was the interesting thing, that, again, there was this very openness in Dow. When I first joined them, they didn't even have a director of research.
Mm-hmm.
The son of the founder, Willard Dow, was not only president, but he was director of research. But he was killed in a plane crash in 48, I think, and I joined in 50.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had a committee for research then. And then they got a director of research in a couple of years. But they'd had so much success with new products like polystyrene and latex paint that just came out of these guys doing things and that were terrific money makers that they didn't worry about it. And I solved problems with the mass spectrometer. It was all, well, Midland, Michigan, I had, I think, 12,000 inhabitants, and Dow employed at Midland employed 15,000 people. You knew what went on lots and lots of places, and I would go to research conferences we were right next to the physical research lab. And this was a very famous lab that had invented polystyrene and latex paint, and I forgot what other things they had. And so I would just go listen, and if they were having some problem I thought mass spec would solve, I would speak up, and they were nice guys, but often, you know, we had a lot of fun, and I got ridiculed, and sometimes I wouldn't even dare speak up. I'd just go around and get a sample anyway. You had to teach them not to send it in quart bottles.
Oh, yeah.
You had to bring your own little sample vial. Can I have a little of that?
Yeah, yeah.
And sure, if we couldn't do anything, I never said a word, but once in a while, we could do something. And I think I've told my specs in polystyrene story. You've heard that one.
Yeah.
Well, there the culprit was carbon tetrachloride, and when the plant manager said infrared couldn't see it, I'd said, you're right, infrared can see it.
So how many of these rescues, firefights, I guess you call them. I mean, when I was at McDonnell Douglas, we'd have these problems pop up, and you always call them firefighting problems, where you know, they would pull out all the stops because, you know, something really important to them was,
yeah,
was giving
that.
A problem. So you had a variety, you were called in on these kind of what I like to call firefighting problems regularly.
Yeah. Well, remember early on, Dow was getting some butadiene process know-how from Germany, from Bottish, I think. Anyway, this Ludo Favell, who was born in Germany, had gone over to do it, and they and he says, "I'm going to send you back samples."
Mm-hmm.
So he airmailed me back little glass vials of gas samples that he made him take from the different places in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get them, and we would, of course, as you say, it's a firefight. We'd run them to finish the work at 3 in the morning, and in those days you cabled the results
mm-hmm.
back.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, my analyses got there before the Germans got their analyses out, and mine were much more detailed because, of course, I had to guess what the isomers were and everything
mm-hmm.
else,
mm-hmm.
but nobody knew any better than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave a chapter and verse on other hydrocarbons that they didn't even look for,
mm-hmm.
and I think they were doing mostly ORSAT analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of it was so early on that even the petroleum people weren't sure. There were some labs that could do this kind of thing really well, but there were not just every place could.
Yeah. So you were at Dow for a while, and then they decided to have you set up a lab in the East.
Oh, right. 1956.
How long did you, then it was about 5 or 6 years that you were in
the mass
spec? Yeah, I went
there in 50, and this was 56. Yeah.
So this was a period when you were really in a hands-on laboratory environment. You were day-to-day dealing with spectra and
and actually, I put in gas chromatography, too,
oh, okay.
in that period, too, with this role of Golgi.
So GC...
G-O-H-L-K-E, Golgi.
Yeah, Golgi. GC was just getting kind of the attention of people.
I had never heard of it until I went to a Gordon conference.
Okay.
And
do you remember which year that was?
54, I think. I always have trouble remembering. I think I've got the original Gordon conference notes, and I look them up every time. But Steve Dalnagar,
D-O-L,
small D-A-L, capital N-O-G-A-R-E, was at DuPont. And he did wonderful things with it. And there was a guy from ICI in Britain, Wilson, Dr. Wilson, I think it was Harold Wilson, I'm not sure. Anyway, they were both described it at the Gordon Conference. And me, I take them aside
apply them with beer.
Applied them with beer and got a whole notebook full of notes. In fact, I rode the train back to Boston with Steve. He became a very good friend. He's just a terrific guy. When I got back to Midland, I said to Roland, "Here's something we got to do."
Mm-hmm.
And Roland's such an inventive guy. Well, he had to do it his way. But our first gas chromatograph was just copper tubing rolled up. For a thermostat, he used a two-quart Dewar.
Mm-hmm.
We had Galmac detectors, only he got in touch with the Galmac salesman, and they got him some experimental model or something that was 10 times as sensitive, or
mm-hmm.
something like that. And he tried different column packings. One of his favorites was Tide soap.
Mm-hmm.
Laundry soap, and we did the same thing with GC that we'd done with mass spec in running samples for people from all from different parts of the company. Only there, we could didn't have to run the samples because Roland would build them a GC and he would go over and install it in the plant and teach him how to run samples.
Hmm.
And he installed more than 200 of these.
Wow.
Before Dow started to buy them commercially. Yeah, he was, Roland was just amazing.
So, I mean, of course, those were the days when you could build, well, I mean, you could still build your own GC today. I mean, that's a very kind of fairly kind of simple concept, but obviously it's much more refined and newer.
Well, and in those days, you didn't care. A gram of sample or a microgram of sample or a femtogram of sample, you had sample.
Yeah.
Sensitivity was no problem. And these things were reproducible. He had temperature control, and,
So was it during that period? So you left the Dow Midland Lab in '56. You said.
Oh yeah, that's when they sent me out to. It was in that period that the other chemical companies got into basic research, and most of them put labs in Europe because that was much more basic.
Mm-hmm.
And we always, well, you're from the Midwest. We always joke about for Midland, Michigan, Boston was just as foreign as Switzerland was to DuPont. And so they sent me out, and they had a little EDTA plant that they had bought.
Mm-hmm.
The
EDTA is ethylene.
Diamine tetraacetic acid.
Okay. This was a kind of like a stock chemical that they used in.
It's a specialty chemical that has all sorts of uses for chelating metals, and very specifically, that you can. Even for medical uses, you can control calcium, but you can for getting rid of iron. And, well, it's even used to treat lead poisoning and things like that.
Okay,
it's a very tight complex. Or ethylene diamine has two amino groups on each end, and tetraacetic acid is out like that, so you've got aminos and carboxyls, and I started the lab there, and one of the big researchers in the field, Art Martel, was a consultant to the Burgsworth Chemical Company, so I inherited him and two of his PhDs.
That's M-A-R-T-E-L-L?
M-A-R-T-E-L-L, right.
And what company was he with?
He was at
Burgs?
No, he was at the Burgsworth Chemical Company is the one Dow bought.
Oh.
Art Martel was at University of town just west of Boston.
Cambridge, no.
Well, it doesn't matter. He then moved from there to IIT and then to Texas A&M, and he spent the last 20 or 30 years of his career. He was department head at Texas A&M, Martin Martel.
Yeah, so, and what was this company that they bought Burgsworth?
Burgsworth, B-E-R-S-W-O-R-T-H. And Martel was just a consultant.
Okay, consultant.
But they're the ones that made EDTA, and they made it in an old garnetting plant.
What's a garnetting plant?
It's a plant that takes old wool garments and makes them back into wool fiber that is then remade into new wool.
So it's
garments.
A recycling operation for wool.
That's right.
Weird.
And the reason there's the virgin wool sign is because
of the garnetting. Okay.
Is because garnetting is the other way.
I see.
Well, it was a new word for me, but this building was built in 1840 or something, and when the tanks were too full, the timbers would creak, and but it was a wonderful place for a lab because you could knock a hole in the wall if you wanted to run a line or anything like that. And they had a full complement of people. So I immediately had a secretary, and we immediately had people that if you needed a hole in the wall, they could do it, and they could weld, and they could.
So these personnel came from the company that were the
Dow owned it by then. Dow had bought it two or three years before that.
So why did they select you to go back east and set up this foreign plant? What? I mean, you were doing mass spectrometry in an analytical chemist mode, and so why did they say, you know, pick you out of the?
You people, not anymore, but people used to remind me what I told them was, well, this is a great opportunity at Dow, and I think mass spectrometry has reached its peak. I told them. I have several people that's remind me that I told them that.
So this is you were essentially kind of getting antsy. You'd done what you could in the mass spec business, and it was interesting for a while, and you were.
If you look around, well, you were in the industry. Look around at people that have been there for 5 or 6 years, and they get antsy, and the company. Keeps them distracted by giving them something different to do, and this is what the company gave me to do. And man, I thought it, oh, is this great stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, and got people in the lab and got doing things, all of a sudden I had lots of time on my hands. So I went back to doing mass spec.
So when you went there, though, you were in charge of setting up a research laboratory, right?
That's right.
So you had to then hire people?
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't anybody of a research caliber there when you appeared on the scene.
Well, there were these two PhDs that did chelation type of research.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that both of them left before I left.
Okay.
But the people I hired were terrific. One of them, George Ola, got the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how do you spell it?
O-L-A-H.
Yeah. So how many people did you end up putting by hiring for?
I left, I think we had 14 PhDs, maybe 35 altogether in the lab.
And you get your direction on what kind of research they were supposed to be doing, or
we were supposed to be doing fundamental research.
Okay.
And supposed to be doing research in different areas that would get the company into different fields.
Okay, but did they specify what they thought of as fundamental? So it was up to you to determine.
The director of research, Ray Boundy, was a chemical engineer. He
Boundy, how do you spell it?
B-O-U-N-D-Y.
Okay.
Great guy. Very good with people. Had a broad knowledge of Dow's processes and chemicals and where they ought to go, but was not a PhD
mm-hmm.
chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we would do something different, he never once complained. Our researchers Furan is a five-membered ring with one oxygen and two double bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with these chemistry with these kind of rings only, and so thiophene has a sulfur there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we came up with compounds that had a very different metal atoms there.
Mm-hmm.
And the and I remember presenting this one. I go back to Midland every couple of months to tell them how wonderful we are.
Mm-hmm.
Presenting this to whatever scientists would come, and
mm-hmm.
Ray Boundy's there, and you know, somebody always said, well, what in the world could it be?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know. but they're sure different. And we sure got a great patent position. Ray Bondi just smiled. What was the other thing about the? Oh, for example, the tin one was the official name for it is Stanol, and in the slide I would have these different things and pronounce them, and then the last picture on the slide was the one with arsenic in it, and I'd say, you know, I'm not sure what we should call this, and then they'd all go through arsehole that you'd hear in the back of the room, and so at least I'd get away with them.
Yeah, yeah.
So we invented arsehole.
Arsehole. So is it Bondi or Boundary? This guy's raised last name.
Oh, Bondi.
Bondi.
Like okay. Mutiny on the Bounty.
Bondi.
Oh, sorry, D-Y. Not Bounty. It's Bondi.
D-Y. Okay.
Like bound in the air.
Okay.
B-O-A-N-D-Y.
So you would get a little bit of flack going back to Midland.
I wouldn't get any flack out of him.
Okay.
No.
So.
And he had a right-hand man, Jack Chamberlain. Jack Chamberlain, who was sort of assistant director of research. And Jack was the guy... Ray was the guy that sat there and smiled and so forth. Jack was the guy that was the communicator, and he would bounce around and get to all people and talk to them. And he's the guy that I could go to afterwards and find out what the lay of the land was.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Bounty wouldn't tell me, but Jack would say, Fred, it's brand new chemistry. Ray is very pleased. I'm very pleased. In fact, he says, we really get a kick out of which people in the audience are the ones that are saying they don't see what good these are going to be.
I see. So.
And for example, one of my scientists had worked with the guy at Indiana that came up with stannous fluoride toothpaste for Procter & Gamble and made it, still makes it.
Mm-hmm.
And he did research in these areas that came up with other compounds that were outside this and had bactericidal and other kinds of specific activities. Well, it was a niche market, but it not only made the company money, but it was one of the first things that Dow then got into the pharmaceutical business, and this was one of the first things they had for this pharmaceutical business, was this stuff that Horst Langer came up with.
How do you spell that?
L-A-N-G-E-R. He was from Germany.
Horst, H-O-R-S-T.
H-O-R-S-T.
Okay.
And in fact, then they bought an Italian pharmaceutical company, Lepetit, I think that's it, L-E-P-E-T-I-T, in Milan.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left the... another researcher I hired was Fred Leavitt, L-E-A-V-I-T-T, who was a polymer chemist, and who had a nice polymer research program there. When I left the lab, Fred Leavitt became the director, and then Dow... actually sent Fred Leavitt, when they bought Lepetit in Milan, sent him over to run that research lab over there. And so, the other part of the story is that I also recruited for Dow in the East Coast universities.
Mm-hmm.
That was enough. Well, I had plenty of time, so I recruited at Harvard and Yale MIT and Columbia and Princeton and all these places.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always say, well, I don't want to work in Midland, Michigan. And I said, well, we have a plant in Texas. Well, I don't want to work in Fremont, Texas. And I said, well, but I'm hiring you for my lab in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I like Boston, yes. But you, then you'll just transfer me to Midland.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's a free country. Look at the Constitution.
Yeah.
And so I hate to say it, but lots of these bright guys that I hired then transferred to Midland. And I don't know if they were any of transferred to Freeport, Texas, but, well, like this Fred Levitt then got the job of running it. So they were, the lab was also a good place to hire people that Dow couldn't hire because who wants to live in Midland, Michigan? Being from Nebraska, was great.
Sure. So you mentioned patent position. So the work that was done, you guys had a patent attorney on the staff there, and you actually worked and made sure you patented the developments. And so this was.
I was the patent liaison, and so I. So Dow had a Boston, no, New York City patent attorney.
Okay.
That they had come do our patents, and I forgot, maybe just well I forgot his name. he was great, and he's at tax time. I can remember, you know, I'm laboring over my income taxes. He says, "Fred, good night. Expenses, put them down." Mm-hmm. He says, "You know what I do?" He says, "I put down every expense I can think of. I keep track of all of the meetings I ought to go to in New York City, talks I ought to hear. I put them all down in my tax form, and then sometimes I don't always go to them, but you know, it's really ones that would have been expensive if I went there." And he says, "Yeah, usually they cut my expenses down by so much when they get it, but then I just add that amount to next year because, of course, I really deserved it, so I just put it on." You know, anyway, he instructed me on how to do patents.
Do you have any idea the number of patents that your operation that developed in that period? Is it like dozens, hundreds, tens?
We got up to where we put in a dozen a year, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
These are all chemical compounds and synthesis routes.
We really did have a wide variety of. George Ola does super acid research,
mm-hmm.
and as I say, after I hired him. And within, I think it was only a year or maybe a year and a half after that, I left and went to Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he kidded me about that. "The only reason I came here, Fred, is because I can put up with you." so he went to Case Western within a year after that. And he's been in Southern California for many years. But he is the person in this super acid field, and it has many great applications, and it's especially good for hydrocarbons and for derivatized hydrocarbons for all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So we got lots of patents on while he was there.
So during this period, you really were functioning not so much as an analytical chemist, but as a more...
I was supposed to be running the place.
Yeah, and so you're a research director and...
I didn't do analysis. Yeah. Well, we did... In my spare time, I did paper mass spectrometry research. Roland and I, the infrareders, had set up an infrared search system in which they put all their reference infrared spectra on punch cards, Holdrith punch cards.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, we did that with our reference file of mass spectra. And we actually published this in Analytical Chemistry in 1959 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the infrareders deserve credit. They had a big switchboard with little toggle switches in it,
mm-hmm.
and the corresponding I think there are 80 holes in a hole in a punch card. Well, there are 80 toggle switches, and so each one corresponded to a
certain wave number,
a wavelength range, and ours corresponded to masses, of course. And you'd go there and toggle them, and then take the reference file of cards and shoot them through the sorter, and out would come the ones that, Sybil Rock had the
McBee chord.
Well, this was easier than that, and then we made it more sophisticated. But anyway, this meant that I could have all the reference spectra with all the masses and so forth on these cards, and I can remember bringing the cards back in my suitcase one time in, back to where we lived in Wellesley. And so these I would use then to write these papers correlating spectra. And the ones for the rearrangement too.
So you were actually developing rules for mass spec interpretation in your quote spare time. Research director opportunity at job at okay.
Now if you ask Timmy, we after we'd been there a while and the fifth child arrived in Wellesley, we bought a house with 9 bedrooms, 6 fireplaces, 4 car garage, and a heating bill that would knock your socks off.
I guess.
From this old wealthy couple, and they sold it to us at what we could afford, I think, because they loved having 5 children in their house. But it was a marvelous house. And so I had one of these little bedrooms that was actually in the maid's quarters of the house that I used for an office, and I used to get up at a couple hours before the rest of the family every morning, get out my cards and
play with your cards.
and the other, I did that a little book on mass spectral correlations, you know.
I'm not sure I've seen that book.
Well, that's one thing about doing it in the office. Mass spectral correlations. I must not be looking at it every day. There. Mass spectral correlations.
Oh, I've seen this, yes. Okay.
It was an ACS publication.
Yes. I might even have a copy of this. So this was the precursor to interpretation of mass spectra?
Yeah. That's, I went through, this is the result of going through every one of those 4,000 cards and recording what I thought was the reason, what the mechanism of where the peak came from.
So it's kind of like your groundwork.
That's what is the basis for my view of mechanisms, is going through what then was a library that nobody else had.
That was published by ACS?
By the ACS, that's right. And then when I got to Cornell. And I had this great Babu Venkataragavan.
Oh, okay.
We brought out a second edition, and this one he did everything in the computer.
Oh, I see.
Or most everything in the computer. And we had a much larger database then. But actually, things came out about the same. Yeah, Bob was great.
So, tell me a little bit, if you would, about your wife's name.
Elizabeth. And
okay.
Ever since her 2-year-old sister couldn't really say Elizabeth and called her Tibby. She's been T-I-B-B-Y, Tibby.
I see.
That's so.
Okay, well, it's an interesting, you know, I've heard of some interesting...
Lisbon and Solja, sir.
Yeah.
All sorts of short names, but hers is a little different than most.
Okay, so then you got the... we're kind of antsy about moving
your
on.
Your talk starts in 18 months.
Okay, well, why don't we stop here?
Oh, I forgot to tell those guys.